Welcome back, WNST Rock Week. I am Nestor, and I am presenting a whole bunch of really cool interviews that I did back in the 1980s and early 1990s when I was the pop music critic at the Baltimore Evening Sun, and before that, the Baltimore News American. My stuff was syndicated in lots of places, and this one's a unique one because, you know, there's a handful of the really big interviews that I had done with folks that now, 30 years later, are Rock and Roll Hall of Famers and icons, and as you'll hear throughout the series, whether it's the Black Crowes and the Red Hot Chili Peppers in their infancy or REM in their prime, then there are just sort of the icons. And this next interview is Billy Joel. Billy Joel called in to my radio show in 1998 when he canceled the show, but it was only because I knew him from 1990. And I'm a old school Billy Joel fan. All of these rock interviews that I'm presenting, I loved music so much as a kid. Styx was the first concert I ever went to. But Billy Joel was very early on in that, after the Glass Houses tour, and he had his problems and his motorcycle accidents and all the hits, you know, from You May Be Right and Still Rock and Roll to Me. And, of course, Piano Man was iconic. But this interview was from 1990, and I had seen Billy Joel, probably 8 or 9 times at that point at the Spectrum. And at the Capitol Center and back and forth. And I know he played Baltimore shows. He played at the Bayou, you know, famously in the 70s before he was a star. And of course, you know, sitting out in LA and tinkling the keyboard. This is a very, very extensive interview. I was actually shocked when I went back because I hadn't listened to any of these interviews since I actually did the interviews back in 1989, 1990, 91. So it had been a quarter of a century before I ever unearthed any of this stuff. And I'm just shocked at how long a time he spent with me. I actually met him at the show, and the era is January 1990s when this actual interview took place. It was a Stormfront tour. He had played in Moscow. He was still married to Christie Brinkley. His daughter was 5 years old. We had at one point during our conversation discussed taking care of children because his daughter and my son are the same age. We talked about the music business, and he talked about wanting to teach later in life and not write songs. I find it fascinating that 25 years later, he still plays, you know, the Ravens Stadium and packs him in and still plays Madison Square Garden once a month. And many of these older interviews, these were, you know, guys that were getting up on 40 years of age, which felt really old to anyone in the rock and roll business. And but I grew up listening to Billy Joel. This was a 4 or 5 years into interviewing musicians. So I was a little bit more comfortable, but as you will hear in this and every one of these old school interviews, there was a very awkward 22-year-old version of me talking to Billy Joel, who I idolized and worshipped. There's a couple of these in my catalog. This is the original interview. It's extensive. It's 38 minutes long. And as in all of these interviews, sometimes it gets a little uncomfortable between journalist and musician, and most of the musicians did not like journalists. Most of the critics were just that. They were critics. So it was they were used to being combative, especially Billy Joel, on the phone with critics. And but this is one of my favorite interviews. I think you'll dig it if you dig Billy Joel. You can laugh at me a little bit because certainly a quarter of a century later, I have to laugh at myself. This is Billy Joel about to play the Capitol Center in 1990 on the Stormfront tour. And this is what it sounded like.
Hello.
Hi, can I speak with Nestor, please?
This is Nestor.
This is Billy Joel.
How are you?
Good, how you doing?
Oh, okay, sir. I guess we did this a little earlier than we expected, but this is fine. In the last 30 minutes, I've come up with more questions about your life than you can probably imagine, so I'll start firing. Why tour at this point? I know a couple years ago you said that that the Bridge Tour would probably be one of your last, if not your last, big undertaking, and I saw you about 10 times on it just to make sure I got my fill, and here you are back.
Well, yeah, I remember I said that. You know what? I probably said that at least more than halfway through the last tour, which was a year and a half long. So I was probably in at least 9 months into the tour. After 9 months of touring, I think on every tour I said, that's it. I'm not going to do this again. But why tour now?
Yeah.
This is a really really good album to do live. That's one reason. I think part of the success of the album is due to the fact that we were thinking about playing this stuff live when we were in the studio. Part of the enthusiasm among the musicians was, I can't wait to do this live. And also, the band, there's some new people in the band, which has kind of regenerated the impetus to perform.
So the old thing was getting a little stale?
Yeah, it was getting stale. The chemistry between the musicians on the last album was just not there anymore. Not everybody, but just a couple of people. It was getting stale. It was getting to be too much of a business. It was getting to be too much of a given. There wasn't enough spontaneity. There wasn't enough fun. There wasn't enough friendship. And with the different change-up in personnel, we've got a lot more good chemistry going for us.
So I just keep reading more and more about your financial situation, which I'm sure you don't want to divulge too much information, but it just seems that...
Well, there's another good impetus to tour.
Do you need to tour?
Yeah, sure I do.
How could a guy with as many, you know, million-dollar sellers as you've had, you know, have to go on the road at your level?
Get my ex-management, and they'll show you how real quick.
What happened through all that? I mean, I really haven't gotten the dirt. I mean,
well, see, it goes way back before then. I mean, I was signed with a guy named Artie Rip. I don't know if anybody knows that part of me. It goes back to the early 70s. My initial record contract, I signed away everything.
Like Rip Off.
Well, you said it. I didn't. Okay, I don't need any more lawsuits. But I signed away copyrights, publishing, record royalties, you name it. And that took me actually up to this album to get rid of him. And then there was my ex-wife, who was my manager, who took half of that. What was left?
Half of nothing.
Well, just half of anything else I made. And now we've got these people who have been with me for 9 years and have pretty much dug me into the hole. So I'm not a businessman, as you can tell. I'm a piano man. But fortunately, I can keep playing the piano long after these people have outlived their usefulness.
Doesn't it seem a shame to you that all this has slipped away from you?
It hasn't slipped away from me. It's been stolen. And it's been blown on bad business deals, and it's been very badly handled. It hasn't slipped away from me. You know, slipping away is something that you've got to handle on.
So, I mean, just what about the emotional attachment you have to these, to your music? I mean, to the things that I guess you'll never see another nickel from Still Rock and Roll to Me or any of that stuff, or you haven't seen a nickel from it.
Well, those are things I'm battling for now. Those are my children, and I will never give up, you know, trying to get my children to belong to me. But, you know, the Beatles went through the same thing, and they don't own their stuff either.
What about John Fogerty? Do you remember his battles, or have you ever talked to him about that?
I haven't talked to him, but I've read about what he's gone through, and I have a lot of great deal of sympathy for him because I know what it feels like.
So when 5 years ago, when it was going on with him, did you ever think it could happen to you, or did you know
it happened to me 5 years ago? It happened to me 15 years ago. It's been going on with me from day one. I mean, I don't really want to get into a Billy whining about his business stuff. That's hope that's not going to be the gist of the interview.
That is not the impetus for the story at all.
But, you know, I know I've been accused of, by a number of critics, of doing things for commercial reasons. Well, always kind of bugged me, and that's why I'd get mad at critics and say, well, if I was doing this for the money, don't you think I'd be better at this? You know what I mean? Wouldn't I be a little bit smarter about money things?
Taking a tour out like this, and I guess you're going to be on the road through 90 and maybe into 91, am I correct in saying that, or what do you plan to cut this thing off?
Well, we're going to go as long as there's a demand for tickets. We toured for a year and a half on the Bridge album, and this album has already gone past the Bridge album. We've only been out for a month, so I'm assuming that we'll tour for at least that long, and maybe longer.
Now, I keep reading things more and more about your want for family life and want for being settled and normal. How does, you know, this is not normal to go out on the road.
No, it's not. This is completely abnormal. Fortunately, the schedule is such that every 6 weeks I'm going to go home, and I'll be home for 2 weeks. which is better than the last schedule we had, because the way it was arranged by these other people the last time, I never got a two-week break. But I will this time. And also, my child is in nursery school, and she can come and see me on the road for extended periods of time. It's not like she's going to miss English Lit, you know?
Right, right.
But it is going to be a strain not being with my family and spending, you know, another year and a half at least in hotels and airports. Is not my idea of fun. Thank God that the musicians are good people, and I'm enjoying playing with them. But this is probably one of the things I'm most bitter about with these other people who did this to me. Now, it's not just the money; it's what they've done to my life.
Because
I always wanted my kid to have a father. Now she don't.
Now they pulled you away from your family in essence, and that makes you even more bitter than any of the other things, I assume.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm going to make sure that my family stays together. If they screwed up my family, then they would really win. You know, money's one thing.
Because you can make more money.
Hopefully.
Trying. All right. So was there something about the last tour that you liked to get you back out into this mess? Was the USSR thing at the end something?
I think that was the highlight. I think that's probably the highlight of my life as a musician, was playing in the Soviet Union. I don't know if anything's really going to top that. Even though, you know, this tour right now is starting out to be like probably the most successful tour we'll ever do. Because we're playing all these multiples. I mean, we've been in like three cities for a month. I'm not used to that. I actually unpacked my suitcase.
So it's not so bad that you're like hopping from arena to arena every night.
No, it's not kamikaze rock and roll touring where it's bang 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 one nighters. We've been staying in one city for a week at a time because we do so many dates. I actually used the drawers in the hotel rooms. I've never done that before.
So why not?
And their hangers. I'm actually using their hangers. You know?
Why not wait till the good weather and go out and play stadiums like the other big acts of your vein tend to do?
Well,
I don't think that's the way to see Billy Joel, but defend my point.
I just the album came out when it came out, and I'm not going to wait around for the summertime for good weather. I mean, I live in the Northeast. I know what cold weather is like. Let's go play. If the demand gets to the point where, you know, we have to. I mean, there's an actual point where you have to do stadiums, where the ticket demand is so great that you'd have to literally burn yourself out by doing one venue in one city for like so long. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
It doesn't even make economic sense anymore to tour at that point, because your expenses are so incredibly high to stay in one place for that long with all those people.
Without buying a condo.
Yeah, without, you know, getting married, settling down, having a family. But we're doing some big places. We're doing this place up in Syracuse, which is an indoor stadium.
Carrier Dome.
We're doing a stadium down in Tampa, Florida, when we go down south. But the rest of them are multiples. I don't. Who the heck knows what's going to happen? But by this summer, we may have to come back and do some stadiums. I don't know if that's the best way to see me, but damn it, I'm going to make sure it's the best show we can do in that kind of venue. I've done stadiums before. I've done the Aloha Stadium in Honolulu. I did a stadium in, the hell was it? A couple of them in New Zealand and Australia. I've done some stadiums. We can actually do it. But right now, the Coliseum show is pretty damn good, though.
Oh, I bet. You're going to be here Wednesday. Can't wait to see it. Now, the USSR, getting back to that a little bit. Did you see the wall crumbling, so to speak, when you were over there? Did you see this glasnost thing happening?
Well, when I was there in 87, I knew that it was a time of incredible transition and change. It felt like the 60s. I wasn't really in Eastern Europe. I was in the Big Onion. I was in Moscow.
Right, right.
And you could tell that there was a palpable excitement about change in the air. It really felt like the 60s. Looked like the 40s. Felt like the 60s. And I guess the response we got from the audience was really encouraging, was really hard. For me, the Cold War ended in 1987. when I went there and I played, boom, that was it. I wasn't going to bomb them. They weren't going to bomb us.
So McCarthyism's over at this point.
Well, I never really bought into it, but to see it with my own eyes was really gratifying to know that what I had felt all along was right. You know, I mean, I used to announce in the States that I was going to play in the Soviet Union back in 86.
And they'd boo.
And they would boo.
Right.
Really disappointed. They said, hey, man, they like rock and roll, too. And I went over there, and they went nuts. They reacted just like a Detroit heavy metal crowd. They went nuts, broke the chairs. Everybody got in trouble, which is what should happen in a good rock and roll show.
what used to happen. Now they have crowd control.
Yeah.
Was it your idea to go?
Yeah, it was my idea. Well, we played in Cuba in 79. I said, well, if we can play for the Cubans, why can't we play for the Russians? And one of the things I wanted to do, the only way we could make the money back was to make these films over there and bring them back and try to market them in America to try to cover the expense of the whole trip. And the biggest comment I got from people here was, hey, they look just like us. I say, yeah, you get it?
You know? They're people too.
Yeah, they like rock and roll too. They're just like you. Oh, wow, I didn't know that. Or people, weren't you scared to be there? Why? It's a lot safer there than it is in Manhattan.
Especially when you got a little bit of entourage with you and a little bit of notoriety, I guess.
Yeah.
So would you go back over there now, and would you like to play East Germany and Romania and the other places that maybe you could or couldn't have gotten into 3 years ago?
We may still do that. We're planning a European tour in May. The only problem is they don't pay. The amount of money that they come up, they offer a Western artist, is not enough to cover like half of the roadie's wages for a day.
So you might be going over there just to build a little friendship base and try to get some people to buy some albums at some point?
I don't know how they're going to buy albums. The only way they're going to buy albums is to go to the West. They're still not, there's no record deal in the Soviet Union.
Well, I mean, the places that are falling now as we speak, the East Germany and the Romanias.
I would go to play there if it was economically feasible for me to play. But I don't see that happening right away. I think it's going to take quite a while. We may be able to go to East Berlin. And we may be able to play in West Berlin, actually, and have East Berliners come. I was asked, kind of funny, by Solidarity a few years ago to come and do a concert there before all this stuff went down. And I was really excited about the prospect of it. Then I looked at the telegram and I realized they sent it to me 2 weeks after the concert happened. So they don't have it all together yet, you know?
That's like dark ages. Fax is the way we work in America.
Yeah, really.
So would it seem like a little, the second trip wouldn't be as good as the first if you were ever to go back to Moscow and Leningrad?
Oh, sure would. I think it would be a terrific, a wonderful renewal to be able to do it. But as I said, they've got to join the world market in terms of how finance works. They asked me when I was leaving the last time, you know, how can we get more artists to come here? I said, you really got to come up with a few quid, Johnny. It's not that we want to rip you off or exploit you because we're capitalists. It's just that we don't want to get punished for coming here.
Break even.
Break even would be fine. I think a lot of artists would like to do that. Even the possibility of coming out a little bit ahead would even attract more people. That's the way the world works.
So I assume you're not planning on touring forever, and I've seen something about you wanting to teach. Now, what are your plans for 10 years from now, and how do you expect to put something like that into work?
Well, I don't have any real plans for 10 years from now. I would hope that I'm not still on a rock and roll grind circuit. Of course, Jagger said that, and he's still doing it.
And he's 40-something.
Yeah, he just turned 47 or 46. Those guys are still blasting away.
He got the job done, right?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe 10 years from now I want to do this again. I can't conceive how that would be possible 10 years from now. But maybe it will be. I don't know, just to prove it to my kids. See, I'm not an old fart. But I don't know. I really do enjoy when I've done seminars and lectures at colleges. I've got all this technical information flying around in my head that I never get to use. And so do a lot of other musicians and writers and people in music. And usually when you do interviews, you get asked questions about your career or about general questions about music. And
and Christy.
Stuff like that. You know, he gets asked questions like, why did I write a certain song in the key of B flat? You know what I mean?
Right.
And these are questions which really are very technical, and I'm an expert on these things, and you can actually help students of music by answering questions like this. And that's happened a lot whenever I do seminars. We do a question and answer, and it's probably one of the most satisfying things I've ever done, answering these questions and knowing that you're actually helping somebody in their life technically. So that may be a future form of touring for me, actually going out and playing, doing a question and answer in a theater or in a lecture hall that's either open to the public or for schools. Maybe playing a few songs on the piano, showing people how things got written, and talking about the music business and trying to advise people to avoid the mistakes I've made in the music business. Things like that. There's a time to be an athlete and there's a time to be a coach, and I'm looking at that coaching time now. I think it's the natural progression of things.
But no one else does it, as far as you know. You would be the innovator of the lecture touring circuit.
Maybe so. I don't think it's been explored yet. I think a lot of people would be very interested in something like this. I know when I was starting out, when I was a teenager, I would have loved to have been able to go to a theater somewhere and ask questions of somebody like John Lennon or Bob Dylan, I think it would have been very helpful for me.
Does it seem unrealistic at this point that you could ever pull that off, being who you are?
No, I've done it before. I don't see why I wouldn't be able to do it again. As a matter of fact, it would simplify any kind of performance thing for me. I mean, look, I wouldn't be traveling around with all these people and all this equipment and all these trucks, and I wouldn't have to be paying for all these hotel rooms and all this travel. It would probably just be me and one or two other people, and just would be a pretty easy way to get around.
All right, well, getting back to this album a little bit, how do you write music under the pressures that you're under, as far as, paying the bills and stuff like that, things that you might, that other people in your position don't have to worry about? For being a world-renowned performer, you got a lot of problems. I guess just like the rest of us, but how do you...
Well, that actually is a great source of material. Whenever you don't have problems, whenever you are out of what the mainstream of life is, I don't really think you have anything to write about anymore. To me, being a human being is dealing with problems. It's confronting them and dealing with them and having them and worrying about them and getting over them and enjoying having gotten over them. I guess all the inspiration for the stuff I write about comes out of the experience of being a human being. I know a lot of people would say, well, now that you're rich and you're married to the supermodel, you've got it made, how can you write about anything? I said, look, even if you think I got it made, you think when I walk in the door that she's a supermodel and I'm a rock star? We don't look at each other like People magazine covers, we're a man and a woman, and we do the same kind of things that men and women do.
My boss told me to ask you about your shopping experience. He said you tell a great story about going into places and buying diapers for your daughter way back when, and I guess it seems like way back when now, and just people bumping into you and saying, hey, are you Billy Joel? And what do you say to them?
Well, I say, yeah, here I am, and they say, what are you doing here? I'm shopping. You're shopping? I'm not sure what the story that he's talking about.
But, it's like they think you pay somebody to do your shopping or something like that. Do you think that's the general...
I would imagine some. Even when I'm driving around a car, people say, what are you doing driving? Like, what am I supposed to have my own private rocket ship or something? I do the same things everybody else does. I've got a family, I've got a body, and I have medical things like other people have. We have a great deal in common. Most people think that, because they read about you, that everything's perfect, like your world is perfect, and that's not how it works. I found that money has created more problems than it's solved, as a matter of fact. Money makes people do very weird, bad, inhuman things. So I don't think you've got it made really until you're dead, and then it's too late.
And you still don't have some of the answers. As far as the hurricane flag on the front of your cover, explain this to me. I think it's really a neat symbolism, like, you know, Catcher in the Rye and that kind of thing.
Well, it does represent a storm front. I don't want to get into the trap of explaining what it is, but it does represent a force 10 on the Beaufort scale, which is a hurricane. It's the worst possible weather conditions that there are. And it's a warning. It means don't go out to sea. It means that, you know, there's a storm front coming.
I think hurricanes are interesting anyway, because once you get hit with the front side, it stops, and then you get hit again. It's sort of like life.
That's true. You've got that little calm in the middle, and then here it comes, and it's going in the opposite direction now. But that doesn't mean, you know, you stay in bed. I mean, you got to go out, and you got to fight the elements. I think for me personally, that symbol represented a great deal of turbulence that I knew was going to be coming in my life. At that particular time, I knew this lawsuit was going to happen. They didn't, but I did.
You knew
and I knew that there was going to be a great deal of upheaval going on with me. But that's, you know, that happens. You know, it's like you have a good year, you're going to have a bad year.
So
the way life is.
Right. I said you went out to Long Island, just rented a little house and did some ditties up on the piano, and this has turned into the storm front.
Well, I live out there. I mean, I have a house that's way out in the east end of Long Island already. I just went a little bit further.
Past Montauk?
Well, I went to... Hold on one second.
Sure. Yeah, we were talking about Long Island, right?
Oh, yeah. Where I live is just before you get to Montauk. And I can't work at home, not with the family there. I have to go out and go to work. Otherwise, why work? You know, I'll play with my kid.
Right.
So I rented a house just, a few miles away out in Montauk.
How does the show reflect the changes in Billy Joel as far as, the whole thing going on with the money and knowing you have to tour?
Well, I don't have to tour. I mean, you don't have to do anything but pay taxes and die.
Right.
How does it reflect?
Well, it seems like, I mean, I remember Vienna, and Vienna's not part of my favorite song by you, and it just seems like, well, you've reached Vienna, and it still isn't good enough at some point, you know.
Well, Vienna, what I meant by Vienna was an old age, and I'm just in middle age now. I just hit middle age.
Well, you should be relaxing. There's no reason you should be running around the country like this.
It's true, but I tell you what, the way we used to tour and the way I'm touring now is a lot more relaxed. I'm very happy with the band. I'm really happy playing this album. And it's been a successful record, and the tour is more successful than any other tour we've had. So on the one hand, all that is pretty damn good. On the other hand, I 9 months from now, I'm going to hate this. You know, I'm going to want to get off the road. But I'll keep doing it, you know, as long as it's fun. If it gets to be... Yeah, if it gets to be slavery and indentured servitude, I'm going to jump off, you know?
Right.
It's really not good to do it like that. But I got a feeling we're going to be able to do this for quite a while, especially with the new band. And I think on stage, there's just a lot of fun going on. We really are having fun. The women in the band have made a lot of difference. There's a little bit of tension up there, which I think is good between the sexes, and it makes for interesting stagecraft.
So what kind of things you put in the show, and there's a changing area? And the last time I saw you, you were changing from night to night. I went one night thinking you were opening Running on Ice, and you were opening with Matter of Trust or something like that, and just...
We're still changing. I think it's always going to change. And just when you think you've got it nailed in one town, you go to another town, and the responses are different in different places. So you adjust.
So you're constantly dissecting the set and...
Always, yeah. I think if you lock yourself into one set, it's a big mistake, because you're going to start getting bored, and it's going to start to be going on automatic pilot, which is not the right way to play. You should play with some edge. There should be some tension up there, and there should also be fun.
So if, I mean, you said you're playing 3 and 4 or 5 days at a time in certain cities. Do you think there are people coming to all five shows?
I don't know. Some somebody told me that they went to every show in the last city we hit, which I think is nuts.
So you didn't give them the same thing every night?
No, they got a different show every night.
Well, tickets just went on sale here this morning for, and you've added another show now here, like March 3rd or something like that, down the road. I know in Philly you're tearing up and putting up and pulling down every other night, it seems like. But does that affect your set at all when you make decisions as far as what goes in and what comes out?
Well, the backbone of the show remains pretty much the same. There are certain songs we'll always do. But then there are optional songs or alternates. By the time we hit Landover, I don't know what the set's going to be. I tell you the truth, we'll do a set tonight.
Where are you tonight, by the way?
Tonight we're in Hartford.
Hartford.
And then Monday we have another show here. It'll probably change again. And after that show, we'll probably come up with something else for Washington. So who knows?
So I see you in Philly every now and then, and you do Captain Jack there all the time. What's the inside joke? I never did really get that.
Well, that's the city that really started my career as a recording artist. I had done a radio show.
Gee, hang on, I got to flip my tape. Is that all right?
Play this song, and it became the most requested song in the city of Philadelphia's history. So, you know, and there was all this big excitement about this guy, Billy Joel. Who the heck is this guy?
And what kind of places were you playing at this point?
We were playing clubs. We were opening up for the Beach Boys and the Doobie Brothers and the Jay Giles Band. Nobody really had heard of me.
Anybody big that came through, you got on the opening act because you could sell some tickets?
I don't think we were selling any tickets at all. I think we were just kind of put there as a favor to the agent, you know. They asked the group's manager, please let me have this guy on the bill because I think he's going to be, something interesting in the future. And that's pretty much what it was. When we got to Philadelphia, the place went nuts. We said, what the heck is going on here? And then we heard the story about what happened with Captain Jack. So that's why I do it in Philadelphia. It's the only place I did it. As a matter of fact, the last time we played there, I didn't even do it.
Did you catch any flack?
The first night we did it, and then I said, I don't know, let's see what happens if we don't do it. And we didn't do it, and I didn't catch any flack. So we'll see.
Philly's famous for flack.
They've been pretty good to me, though.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a good rock and roll town and all that, but it's just, I know they're tough on their sports people. As far as the hits go, I mean, how gratifying is it to have another number one song now after 5 years or something? I mean, did you see a number one hit on the bridge when you wrote it, you know, some of that stuff?
To tell you the truth, I really don't think about number one hits. When I make an album, I write an album. I write on it, and I sit down, and I go, okay, here's an album, and then I hand it in to the record company, and I say, here, now it's your turkey, you guys figure it out. I don't really think about what's a hit or not. I think about what I like on a record. And after that, it's pretty much their decision what's going to be a single or not. On the Bridge, I wasn't happy with the Bridge album because I thought about half of it I like and half of it I don't like. I think I could have done better had I spent more time on it.
I thought towards the end it just seemed like it started to move real fast with the Lauper song and the Wimwood song. I thought the beginning was... it just seemed like you put a lot more time in the beginning than the end. Am I correct in saying that or no?
Probably did.
Is it all wet?
More interest in the record. And then halfway through it kind of petered out because the band... It was a drag working with the band at that point. The magic just wasn't there with Phil Ramone like it used to be. I was getting an incredible amount of pressure from my ex-management to get the thing out so they could get their piece of it. And I would also just had a kid, and I really didn't want to spend my life in a studio. So I can hear the seams in that album. I see the rivets, and it doesn't thrill me. Which is why this album is so different. The whole premise, actually, of this new album was, I want to have fun. God damn it, I'm going to have fun. And if it ain't fun, I'm going to walk away, and then I'll start it up again. But I'm not going to stay in there if it ain't fun. And I think it shows on the record that there's a lot of fun on this one.
When did you bring Mick Jones in?
When did I bring Mick in? We got off on a tangent somehow.
we started between the bridge and Stormfront, somewhere in making these albums and what went into making these albums and why one is a hit and one isn't.
Did you hear any hits on the bridge, number one? You know what? We had a number one in, I don't know, 52nd Street album was a number one album. And like The Stranger was like a number two album. I mean, at that point, you know, you're number two. What's the difference? All right, so you're not number one, but you're like, you're not number 89 either. You know what I mean?
Right.
Number one, I think, means a lot in this business, but I think that's a competitive thing. The thrill for us is like platinum records. The thrill for us is sold out shows. The thrill for us is an album that lasts a long time on the charts, which means it's got legs. Number one, I've had number one records. Like Tell Her About It was number one, and Uptown Girl was number three, but Uptown Girl sold more than Tell Her About It. So number one can be very misleading. It's just a number. But it means a lot to a lot of people in this business. So it's gratifying for me to know that the people who have hung out with me for so long, the same sound guy, the same light man, the same drummer, it meant a lot to them to have a number one record. That's what's gratifying about number one. That it, you know, those people can go and say, yeah, we just had a number one record. Well, for me, it's not that meaningful.
Well, I talked to some people from Capitol a few weeks ago, some A&R people and those kinds of things, and they talked to McCartney when he was in New York a few weeks ago, and they said that he just seemed like he wanted a hit so badly because he hasn't had one in so long,
right.
And he just hasn't had maybe the ego trip, maybe whatever. What, you know, just wants to know that he can still cut the mustard, you know, so to speak, with the public. And
right.
Did you ever feel any of that, or did you think when Stormfront came out, well, maybe it'll sell, maybe it won't, or
not? I really wasn't worried about it because all the albums that came out before this one had sold millions of albums.
Right.
I mean, I may not have been number one, but I was never out of the top 10. Every album that we came out, I think The Bridge went to like number 7, and Innocent Man was number 3. What else? The Nylon Curtain was somewhere like a number 5, top 5 album. The Greatest Hits album was a top 10 album. I mean, they've all been in the top 10, and they've each sold millions of albums in their own right. So I guess it's like the Michael Jackson curse. Once you've done a thriller, everything else after that looks like a flop.
Right.
No matter how many millions of records you sell. And it's a deadly game that people can get caught up in, and I really haven't been caught up in it, to tell you the truth. And if I become an anachronism, and if it's proven to me that my music is extinct and radio will not play it and people don't want to hear it and nobody buys it, hey, I'll go do something else, you know? But I'll always be a musician. It really don't bother me.
So you'll write songs forever, even if no one ever gets to hear them, or?
I can write songs for other people. I can write music that isn't even songs. I can write music that has no lyric in it. I can write instrumental music, symphonic music, piano music, music for movies, maybe music for Broadway musical. I mean, there shouldn't be any limitation to what kind of music you can write.
Have you ever considered any of those avenues? Just say, to hell with this rock and roll, I'm going to write a musical. Or have you ever gotten to the point where you're just getting fed up with this? Or
I haven't done it yet, but I'm sure that a day is going to come pretty soon when I'm going to do that, when I get tired of the music business rat race game. Where you got up, hey, top 3, number 5, hey, top 5, platinum, double platinum, critic, tour. I say, hey, the hell with this, man. You know, I want to try something else. As a matter of fact, I look at this part of my life as maybe a journeymanship where I'm going to be doing something else soon. You know, you look at these guys. Irving Berlin lived to be 101.
What's going to happen to Billy Joel if he lives to be 101?
Who knows? But I think being productive is one of the things that keeps you alive. You know, Toscanini lived to be in his 90s. Tchaikovsky, the same thing. Rachmaninoff, Rubinstein, they all lived to be old guys because they were productive. I think if you just, you know, you rise to the top of the heap in pop music and then you disappear, I think you're not going to live too long. You know, I got a whole life to live.
Do you need the roar of the crowd, though?
No, I sure don't. It's fun to hear it, but that's not why I do what I'm doing. I know that there are people who need that. They crave, like, the love of an audience. I got the love of a really good woman, and I got the love of my child and my friends. I really don't need love beyond that. But I like to play.
All right. With Mick, now, back to question number two. When did you bring him in, and was it through Mark Rivera that you knew Mick? Or
no, I had met Mick a number of times on and off, just socially backstage. I met him at a Steve Winwood show, and I met him with Jan Winner, and I met him with a couple of different people that I know. It was always very kind of nice and polite. You know, hi, Mick, how you doing? A little chit-chat, and that was it. But I was talking to Eddie Van Halen about doing co-production on this album. And Eddie was excited about doing it, and I wanted to work with him, but the schedules just didn't work out. And he recommended Mick Jones because he had worked with Mick.
Boy, 5150, boy, that ripped it up. That was a...
Yeah. And he said, you know, check out Mick. So I said, well, okay. And then I was talking with someone about Mutt Lang. And then I heard that Mutt Lang also worked with Mick. So this name kept coming back, Mick Jones, Mick Jones, Mick Jones. So I called him up. I said, you know, you want to talk about doing something? And we got together, and in 5 minutes, I just hit it off with this guy. We just knew we were going to be able to work together. He's a songwriter himself, and he's a guitarist, a very good guitarist, by the way. And that gives him an insight into what I do. He's also English, and the English are kind of kinky in terms of production. I like English records. They have strange, perverted things going on in them. They're very adventurous that you don't find in a lot of American records. Americans tend to be very traditional
conservative
approach to the recording technique. And the British kind of come in and they use whips and chains and, you know, incense and weird stuff. You know what I mean? They're just a very, very lighthearted approach to, you know, the recording studio.
Where would we be without the punk movement?
There you go. Hey, but even before that, you go back to the Beatles.
Beatles, that British invasion.
Yeah,
what they called it.
And then you go into listen to some of these records by Hendrix that were done in England, or Cream,
Clapton, yeah.
And then you listen to these Led Zeppelin productions of what Jimmy Page did in the studio with Led Zeppelin. It's amazing stuff. So there's a long tradition of British production that I've always admired, and I finally got a chance to do it with Mick.
All right. Well,
you know, it's good. It's called Drums in Your Face.
It's a big beat. All right. Well, I certainly appreciate your time, and you know, spending 45 minutes on the phone. I think this is the longest interview I've ever done, but I appreciate you talking to me today in Hartford, and